Marriage usually begins with some kind of romance, and it doesn't take very long before the couple moves into reality.
Elizabeth Elliot says, "Hollywood's notion of love is millions of miles from the slightest comprehension of what the love of God is all about." Welcome to Gateway to Joy, a ministry of Elizabeth Elliot, author of Quest for Love and Love Has a Price Tag. Helping you lovingly put God's principles into action in your daily life, here's Elizabeth.
You are loved with an everlasting love. That's what the Bible says. And underneath are the everlasting arms. This is your friend Elizabeth Elliot, talking with you this time about romance and reality. I have to admit that there was a certain amount of romance in my imaginations of going in to live with a savage tribe that had killed my husband. But as with every aspect of discipleship, whatever may look like romance from a distance turns into hard reality. And I don't mean hard in the sense of difficult always, but discipleship works down where we live, doesn't it? Like marriage, there are a lot of amazing similarities between discipleship and marriage. Marriage usually begins with some kind of romance, and it doesn't take very long before the couple moves into reality, finding out that they're living with a person who is less than perfect. And there are always certain aspects which are unexpected in both discipleship and marriage. Well, I have been telling you about the approach to Alca territory, beginning to live in a little clearing in the eastern jungle of Ecuador on a river called the Tiwano, with a people who had been Stone Age people who wore no clothes except a piece of string around their hips, and who in 1956 had killed five American missionaries. They were called Aucas by outsiders. Quechua Indians called them Aucas because it means naked or fierce. And here I was with my little three-year-old daughter living in an Auca house. It had six poles and a thatched roof. No walls, no floors, and no furniture. Usually I would be awakened early in the morning by the sound of someone singing. The Aucas had their social hour between 2 and 5. That sounds a little odd to us, but if you think about the fact that they had the good sense to go to bed with the chickens, they went to bed as soon as it got dark at night rather than sit up and try to be sociable when they're exhausted from a hard day's work. So if you go to bed at 6:30 or 7, you're going to wake up somewhere between 2 and 5 and not find it too difficult to get up. Well, they didn't have to get out of bed to begin their social hour because everybody lived in a house with no walls. It was a small clearing, and conversation could be carried around from house to house, relayed if anybody missed anything, but you could hear most of what went on. And the song was a way in which people often began the social hour of the day, a man simply lying in his hammock, waking up and beginning to sing a song which sounded like this. I've counted as many as 70 repetitions of verse 1. And then they go on to verse 2, etc., etc. Well, I won't go through every minute of the day, but the first thing that would happen would be that an announcement would be made when I would open my eyes, because I, being a freak in their midst, a foreigner and an outsider, and apparently retarded because I didn't speak their language, they watched everything that I did with the greatest unflagging interest. There were two boys who had established themselves on an observation platform in the house next door to mine. Their names were Komi and Kinda. And Komi and Kinda were two teenage boys whose black eyes would be looking directly into mine when I opened mine in the morning, and they would immediately make the first announcement of the day, which was Baro Nyani Mungamba, which means she's awake. And that stunning piece of news would be relayed from house to house all the way around the clearing. She's awake. I would get myself out of my hammock, unwrap myself from the blanket in which I slept, hang the blanket up underneath the thatched roof, and take out from an Indian carrying net a rubber bag in which there was a transistor transceiver radio, which had been built for us by radio engineers of missionary radio station HCJB in Quito. I would then start to carry this contraption across the clearing to connect it to an aerial on the far side. And as I started across the clearing, the second announcement would be made, which was, "Apeninga unge." That means, "There she goes with that talking thing again." Apeninga was their word for the radio. And as I walked across the clearing, every step would be accompanied by sound effects. Eh, 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 eh. Can you imagine how sheepish that made me feel? I didn't know whether to keep in step or to shift my gait quickly in order to throw them off. But after a day or two, you realize that you are really expected to provide entertainment, and you might as well just go along with it. Well, we had a certain number of inconveniences. We had a lovely river that ran past our house. We got our cooking water from the section upriver. We did our bathing and our clothes washing in the section in the center. We did washed our dishes there, too, and the bathroom was around the bend downriver. Now, I have to say that it wasn't exactly my idea of convenience. A kitchen sink is a good idea for washing dishes, and I can certainly think of better bathroom facilities than a muddy jungle river, muddy part of the time anyway. But it was not nearly so bad as my descriptions of it may sound. People say, "How did you stand it? How do you live in such a primitive situation?" But the truth is, you know, we human beings are really quite adaptable, and things never turn out to be nearly as bad as we expect them to be. The translation of a romantic adventure, a dream of spiritual victories, into reality is always a very daily, very costly thing. The translation of one's romantic notions of marriage into reality becomes a costly thing, a thing which invariably requires sacrifice. I've been thinking a lot lately about the fact that love always requires sacrifice. And if we never have to sacrifice for somebody, we never really learn to love them as deeply as we do if we've sacrificed. I think this explains the deep love of parents for their children, the fact that both have made costly sacrifices. I don't want to dramatize my life with the Indians in the jungle by making it sound more costly, more romantic, or more difficult than it was at all. So it wasn't sacrifice that was the uppermost thought in my mind, but it did get very humdrum. You do get used to things, and what may have looked like romance from a distance turns out to be reality. And one day follows another, and you get used to the fact that everybody sits around talking a language you can't understand, and it gets pretty boring after a while. And there were things about it which were not entirely to my tastes. But discipleship always involves things which are not necessarily to our tastes. There's a certain amount of romance when we think of ourselves as followers of Jesus Christ. We can look at, quote, spirituality, unquote, with dreamy, vague notions of holiness and sanctity. But when it begins to impinge directly on the way we like to live, there's nothing very romantic about that, is there? You might think, "Oh, it would be great to go and live in a jungle clearing for a week or two. I'd like to visit a place like that. I think that would be fantastic. And it would be interesting, I guarantee that. But would you really want to live there?" Well, probably not for very long. The idea of marriage might be a dream of happiness and fulfillment, but very soon it becomes an invasion, an all-out revolution of inconvenience. I said this not very long ago in a public meeting, and afterwards I got a really angry letter from a young couple telling me that I had left out all the joys of marriage and that they felt that it was entirely untrue to say that marriage is an inconvenience. Well, perhaps I could say it's merely a difference of opinion, but in actual fact, I don't think I've ever talked to a couple who has not acknowledged that there are a good many inconveniences in marriage. It's an invasion of privacy. One loses one's independence, the right to make unilateral decisions. There are a good many things which are upheavals, revolutions and revelations in marriage. The same thing is true in discipleship. Do you remember the story of the rich young man who came to Jesus? And when Jesus told him that he had to sell everything he had, his ideas of becoming a follower of this Jewish rabbi seemed to fade into the background. And in Luke 14, verses 25 to 33, we read this: "Once when great crowds were accompanying him, Jesus turned to them and said, 'If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, even his own life, he cannot be a disciple of mine. No one who does not carry his cross and come with me can be a disciple of mine.'" Jesus was immediately disabusing the crowds of any romantic notions that they might have of following him. If it was going to cost them something, were they going to have to hate father, mother, wife, children, brothers, and sisters in order to be his disciples? Jesus was laying it out before them that it was going to cost them something. Not that he meant literally hate in the usual sense, but I think he was contrasting their feelings for their relatives with their genuine love of him. And if it ever came to a choice, it would have to be Jesus Christ. "No one who does not carry his cross and come with me can be a disciple of mine." That brings romance down to reality.
You've been listening to Gateway to Joy with Elizabeth Elliott, author of over 20 books, including Shadow of the Almighty, The Life and Testament of Jim Elliott. Join us next time for more encouragement and challenge from Elizabeth Elliott. This has been a production of the Bible Broadcasting Network.